mounted, and his remaining men tightened in readiness. Divas's men charged through the shattered gates with a snarl. They streamed through the rain towards the guest house, making no effort to approach stealthily. The entire reason he'd used gunpowder to open the gate, instead of simply clambering over the wall, had been to fix the guardsman's attention as firmly on his attack as he could. He wanted Charlian's protectors looking his way when Larrach and Abelin, who had climbed over the wall, hit them unexpectedly from the sides. Divas himself was one of the first through the gate. A quarter of his 85 men carried arbalists, although the chance of their actually getting to use them in a fight like this one was going to be remote. All of the temple loyalists carried swords as well, but the truth was, as Divas was well aware, that the majority of the attackers were only mediocre swordsmen at best. Some of them, like Divas himself, were probably as good as any Imperial Guardsman. Most had only limited military experience, and he found himself wishing he'd armed the lot of them with halberds or pikes, even lizard spears. Getting this many men into position to attack the convent without anyone noticing had been difficult enough, even using weapons which could be easily hidden in the sort of agricultural wagons that wouldn't raise too many eyebrows in such a lightly inhabited area. Trying to do the same thing with 10 or 12 foot pikes would have been far more difficult. He'd known and accepted that from the very beginning, but he hadn't counted on how great an advantage the length of the guards' rifles was going to give them. Whatever Larrach and Abelin might think, he knew they were going to take more casualties, probably heavy ones, before this night was over. But with a numerical advantage of more than 6 to 1, they could afford casualties.
"Watch the flanks!"
Hoskins shouted, as the first charging figures loomed up dimly through the stormy darkness. Then a sudden, livid flash of blue-white lightning painted the darkness purple, and showed him the mass of men hurtling towards him, just as the oncoming temple loyalists hit the lumps of stone Sea Hamper had scattered across the approaches to the guest house. The guard lieutenant's lips skinned back from his teeth as men went down, some of them screaming with the pain of shattered ankles, and their companion's headlong charge faltered. The surprise didn't even come close to stopping them, but it broke them up, left holes in their ranks, and slowed their momentum significantly. The first of them reached the guard's position behind the arc of wagons and agricultural equipment, protecting the guest house's only door. They flung themselves up and over the obstacle, only to find the deadly bayonets waiting on the other side. Sharp-edged steel punched into soft flesh, opening bellies and chests, slashing throats, and men shrieked in agony as blood splashed and steamed in the pounding rain. The bayonet drill of the Imperial Guard had been developed by Major Clareik and Captain Athrawis. It recognized not only a rifle's reach advantage over a sword, but also the fact that a rifle was shorter and handier than a spear or pike, that it could be used to parry or block as well as to attack, and that it could kill or cripple with either end. The men attacking Hoskins' guardsmen had never confronted anything like it. They'd expected the rain to neutralize the guardsmen's rifle fire, and so it had. What they hadn't expected was the sheer lethality of bayonet-equipped rifles in the hands of men who knew exactly what they were doing with them. Mitron Divas's eyes widened as the first dozen of his men tumbled back from the improvised barricade, writhing in agony or already dead. It was impossible for him to actually see what was happening, but it was obvious that the guards' bayonets were even more effective than he'd feared they might be. The remnants of his front ranks drew back, and he swore as they pulled away from the piled wagons and carts. He understood their shock, but giving the defenders time to recover from the initial onslaught was the worst thing they could possibly have done.
"Hit them!" he bellowed. "Hit them!"
Lieutenant Hoskin felt a surge of hope as the attackers recoiled. He knew it was irrational, given the number of men out there, but it was obvious they'd been unprepared for the savagery of their reception. They drew back, not quite milling uncertainly, but clearly hesitant to engage again. Then he heard a single raised voice.
"Hit them!"
it shouted, harsh with command, and the mass of men snarled as it came on once more. Dyvis's men surged back towards the guest house. Between broken ankles and bayonets, they'd lost a quarter of their strength in the first attempt, but there were still more than twice as many of them as there were of Hoskin's guardsmen, and this time they had a better idea of what they were up against. There'd never been any lack of courage or determination on their part. It was the surprise which had set them back on their heels, and this time they weren't surprised. They came on, shouting their hatred, hurling themselves into the guards' teeth, and suddenly still more attackers were slamming in from either side as Larocque and Abelin brought their men into the assault. The guardsmen on the flanks turned to face their new enemies, but this time they were simply too many of them. Sheer weight of bodies carried them forward and over the barricade. The guardsmen's discipline and training held them together, pairs of men fighting as teams, trying to cover one another, but the melee enveloped them, and madness reigned. Discipline and training could accomplish only so much, even with all the courage in the world behind it, and the teamwork which had spelled possible survival came apart, overwhelmed by numbers and chaos. The night disintegrated into madly swirling knots of individual combat, and there were too few guardsmen to win that kind of fight. The Imperial Guard died hard, but it died. Charlian Armok thrust the rifle barrel through the loophole Seahamper had cut and squeezed the trigger. The brutal recoil of the big bore black powder rifle hammered her slender shoulder unmercifully. She felt as if a horse had just kicked her in the collarbone, but she turned and half threw the fired weapon to Daishin Taso, then snatched up the last one from the rank standing against the wall. Most of the gun smoke had stayed outside, but the smoke from the priming pan hovered and swirled, rising towards the bedchamber's ceiling to join the cloud already hanging there. Someone hammered at the outside of the shutter, and a cluster of arbalest bolts hissed through the shutter. One of them snarled past Charlian's head, missing her by inches before it buried itself in the bedchamber door, and she thrust the rifle's muzzle through the loophole almost blindly and squeezed the trigger again. Agony shrieked in the night like a tortured horse. The hammering on the shutter ceased, and she dodged to one side, reaching for the first of the waiting pistols, as yet another bolt splintered its way through the disintegrating shutters and sizzled past her. Edward Seahamper fell back, fighting desperately. Somehow, Brynden Ternier managed to stay with him, covering his left flank, as they cut their way through the wild, rain-and-thunder-lashed madness, trying frantically to stay between the attackers and the guesthouse door. Behind them, they heard the whip-crack sounds of gunfire, and fresh desperation slammed through Seahamper as he realized what that meant. His mind captured fragments of memory. Lieutenant Hoskin, bayoneting one foe, his rifle spinning in his hands as its butt crushed another man's skull, and then the sword driving in under his arm, through the opening in the side of his cuirass, and the lieutenant going down. Another guardsman, fighting desperately against two opponents, somehow holding both of them at bay, until a third took him from behind and cut his throat. A sword opened a bleeding gash on Seahamper's own cheek. Another hammered the breastplate of his cuirass. A third glanced off his helmet, and somehow he and Ternier were still on their feet, still falling back to where the pistol shots cracked behind them. They reached the guesthouse door, and Ternier shouldered Seahamper behind him as a fresh rush surged towards them. Seahamper staggered backward, half falling through the doorway, and his heart twisted as two swords cut Ternier down before he could follow. There was no time to feel grief. There was only the desperate need to somehow protect the Empress he'd guarded since she was a little girl, the young woman he'd helped to raise, and the monarch he'd proudly sworn to serve. The Temple Loyalists could come at him only down the hallway now, and he bellowed his own hatred as he met them with his red-running bayonet. Hot blood turned the stone floor slick underfoot, and bone crunched as one of the Temple Loyalists slipped and sprawled full length, and he drove the butt of his rifle savagely downward onto the fallen man's neck. His world consisted solely of that hallway, of the men storming forward along it, of the growing terrible ache of his arms and the stink of blood. Thunder bellowed explosively, louder than ever, shaking the entire guest house, but it was a distant thing, unreal and unimportant. And because it was, he never realized that this thunder came not from the west, but from the east. The pistol roared. The shape which had loomed in the window tumbled back out of sight, and Charlian's slim hands and wrists felt as if she'd just hit them with a hammer as she turned to toss the fired pistol to Daishin Teso. But the guardsman didn't take it. He sat still and silent in his chair, hands frozen in mid-motion by the arbalist quarrel buried in his left eye socket.
"I've got it, Charlian!" Carlson Reyes shouted.
He snatched the pistol from her and started reloading it, as she and Teso had taught him. His hands were clumsy with the unfamiliar task, but he jerked his head at the window.
"You worry about that!"
"Go on! Go on!"
Mitran Divis's voice was hoarse and cracked. His throat felt raw and broken, but he continued to shout, whipping his men on with his voice. He heard Charles Abelin shouting in snatches even through the tumult as well, but Larocque's voice had gone silent. He saw the two guardsmen fighting in the very doorway of the guesthouse, and then one of them was down, trampled under the boots of his Temple Loyalists as they stormed forward. The madness had them by the throat. Survival itself had become unreal, immaterial, beside their driving need to reach their objective.
"It's a good thing we don't want her alive after all."
The thought flashed through some tiny segment of his brain, and he knew it was true. His men's bloody-fanged hatred and determination would have made it almost impossible to take Charlian alive now, even if they'd wanted to.
"I don't..."
His thought broke off as an impossible peal of thunder crashed overhead. It was scarcely unexpected. Although the rain had almost stopped for the moment, the storm was far from over. But this thunder crack was so loud, so violent, that he flinched. And then, suddenly, there was one more guardsman still on his feet. Divis blinked, scrubbing at his eyes to clear the rainwater still running out of his soaked hair, trying to figure out where that single guardsman had come from. It was as if he'd materialized out of the air itself. The Temple Loyalist's eyes narrowed suddenly as he realized that this guardsman wasn't soaked with rain.
But that was impossible, wasn't it?
He thrust the question aside. There would be time to worry about details later. Right now, he had other things to attend to, and he charged. This one doesn't have a rifle either, he realized, as the guardsman drew two swords. One was considerably shorter than the other, and something about them joggled a scrap of memory. Something about someone who carried two swords. The back of his brain was still grappling with the memory when a battle-steel katana, moving so fast he never actually saw it move at all, slashed his head off his shoulders.
What is it about thunderstorms and assassination attempts?
The question darted through Merlin Athrawus's mind as Divus's head flew, just as the rain began pounding down once more. It was a distant thought, lost below the steely focus of his desperation as he charged into the temple loyalists from behind. A part of him twisted in anguish, crying out in useless protest as he saw the imperial guardsmen sprawled amid the tangle of their enemies' dead. He'd known every one of those men. He'd helped train them, helped select them for their duty, and he'd watched every one of them die through his snark's remotes while the recon skimmer hurtled through the safehold sky at better than Mach 5. Just flying at that velocity had constituted a risk he knew he couldn't truly justify. Despite the skimmer's stealth systems, that kind of speed in atmosphere generated so much skin heat that an orbital scanner, like the ones which might well be incorporated into the orbiting kinetic bombardment system Langhorne had left behind, just might detect it anyway. Yet even at that speed, it had taken him an hour and a half to make the flight from Coruscant. No one on Safehold had ever heard the incredible thunder of a supersonic aircraft at low altitude. Not until tonight, and very few of those who had just heard it were going to survive the experience, he thought grimly. Without the courage and determination of the men who had died in Charlian's defense, he would have been too late anyway. Even now he might be, and his sapphire eyes were merciless as he sliced into the temple loyalists. Most of them never had a chance to realize anyone new had joined the battle. Merlin's nervous impulses used fiber optics, not chemical transmission. When he released the governors he'd set to keep himself from betraying his more-than-human abilities too badly, his reaction speed was 100 times that of a flesh-and-blood human, and his impossibly sharp battle-steel swords were driven by muscles 10 times as powerful as any mortal man's. He seemed to simply stride through his enemies, moving almost slowly, yet bodies cascaded away from him. The first few men he faced died far too quickly for them to realize there was anything particularly odd about the man killing them. But as the lightning picked him out, flashed in stroboscopic spits of brilliance from his flying swords and the sprays of blood trailing in their wake, their fellows recognized, however dimly, that they faced something they'd never imagined was possible.
"Demon!"
a voice wailed.
"Demon!"
Merlin paid no attention. There were 20 men between him and the guest house. 3 of them lived long enough to try to run. Edward Seahamper had no idea what was happening outside the guest house. All he knew was that the seemingly endless stream of attackers who'd been crowding in upon him had abruptly disappeared. He could still hear shouts and screams through the tumult of the thunderstorm, though, and a pistol cracked behind him yet again. He turned and ran down the short hallway to the bedchamber door.
"It's me, Your Majesty!" he shouted as he put his shoulder to the closed door.
He burst through it into a bedchamber reeking of powder smoke just as Charlian stepped back from the shuttered window with a raised pistol in both hands. Gunsmoke hovered like a thick, blinding fog, but he saw the last of the broken shutters fly into fragments as a human body hurled itself against them, and a man burst halfway through the opening. The intruder froze as he found himself staring into the muzzle of Charlian's pistol at a range of less than 3 feet, and then Seahamper felt as if someone had just smashed his ears between two sledgehammers as she squeezed the trigger. She staggered a half-pace backward with the recoil, and the back of her enemy's head disintegrated as the massive bullet exploded through his skull. He disappeared back out the window in a spray of blood, tissue, and snow-white splinters of bone. And the Empress turned towards Carlton Reyes for another. But the priest, too, was down, an arbalest bolt standing out of the center of his chest, while blood pooled thickly on the floor beneath him. Charlian's face crumpled as she saw him, but then Seahamper shoved past her just as yet another Temple Loyalist tried to force his way through the window. The new assailant looked up, then screamed, both hands clutching at his chest, as Seahamper drove a vicious bayonet thrust between his ribs. The guardsman twisted his wrists as he recovered his bayonet, and another Temple Loyalist shrieked and fell away from him as he thrust yet again. Behind him, Charlian reached for the last loaded pistol with frantic haste, and Seahamper swore harshly as another man tried to clamber through the window. He thrust yet again, and then, abruptly, there were no more attackers. Merlin Athrawis recovered. The corpse slithered off his battle-steel blade, and suddenly he was the only man standing in the convent courtyard. He looked around slowly, literally knee-deep in bodies, and for once his eyes were as hard as the composites of which they were made. This time he could afford to leave no survivors to tell wild tales about the Sajin. No doubt most of those tales would have been explained away as wild exaggerations, the way all the other tales about Merlin had been. But this time, the mere fact that Sajin Merlin had been here at all would be enough to generate all the accusations of demonic influence which had to be avoided at any cost. He'd already dispatched half a dozen of the Temple Loyalists wounded, and little though he liked the thought of killing men who couldn't fight back, this time he was prepared to make an exception. It's the penalty for treason anyway, and it's not as if I didn't catch them in the act, he thought harshly, as he waded through the tangled drifts of men who were already dead, dealing with his grim task. He closed his ears to the pleas for mercy, to the prayers, and to the curses, and concentrated on dealing death as cleanly and as quickly as he could. And then there were no living men in the entire convent courtyard. But that didn't necessarily mean none of the attackers were left, he thought. Rain and darkness were feeble obstacles to his enhanced vision, and he easily picked out the two men waiting by the main gate. He zoomed in, and his mouth tightened as he recognized them. Bishop Miles looked at Alvin Shume as the screams, shrieks, and sounds of combat abruptly ceased. The bishop's eyes were shadowed and dark, sick with the reality of the bloodshed and carnage he'd unleashed in the precincts of one of God's own convents. He'd thought he was prepared for what it would be like. He'd been wrong. "Please, God," he prayed silently, "let it be over. Let your will be done, but I beg you to spare me more of this." God returned no answer, and even as he prayed, Halcom knew it would be easier next time, and even easier the time after that. He didn't want it to be, but what he wanted couldn't change what was. "At least it's finally over, this time," he thought, and closed his eyes as he murmured another prayer, this one for the soul of the young woman who had just died at his men's hands. He was still praying when a deep, icy voice spoke. "Bishop Miles, I presume," it said, and his eyes flew open, for he'd never heard that voice before in his life. Shock bleached the color from his cheeks as he found himself facing not Divus or Larrach or Abelin. This man wore the black and gold of the House of Armagh, and Halcombe had never seen him before. But then a sudden stab of lightning blazed sapphire in the guardsman's eyes, and Halcombe's heart seemed to stop beating. Only one Imperial guardsman had eyes that color, but he was with the Emperor in—
"You can't be here," he heard his own voice say, almost calmly.
"No, I can't be," the man in front of him agreed coldly, and he smiled. Shumei moved suddenly, his hand darting towards his belt and the dagger sheathed there. The guardsman's eyes never flickered. He didn't even look at Shumei. His empty left hand simply snapped out like some impossibly swift serpent, closed on the priest's neck and twisted. Shumei jerked violently. Halcombe heard a ghastly crunching sound, and then the guardsman opened his hand again. Halcombe's aide slithered to the ground in a boneless heap, and the guardsman's thin smile could have frozen the heart of the sun.
"2 hours ago," he said softly, "I was in Coruscant, my lord bishop."
Halcombe shook his head slowly, disbelievingly, his eyes huge.
"Demon," he whispered.
"I suppose, in a way," the other man agreed. "By your lights, at any rate. But you failed, Bishop. The Empress is alive. And I tell you this now, your church is doomed. I will personally see to it that it is erased forever from the face of the universe, like the obscenity it is." Halcombe heard someone whimpering and realized it was himself. His hand rose, trembling uncontrollably, as he traced Langhorne's scepter in the air between him and the nightmare he confronted. That nightmare simply ignored his hand, totally unaffected by the warding sign of banishment, and Halcombe's breath sobbed in his nostrils.
"Your Langhorne is a lie," the guardsman told him coldly, precisely. "He was a liar, a charlatan, a lunatic, a traitor, and a mass murderer when he was alive. And if there truly is any justice in the universe, today he's burning in hell with that bitch Bedard beside him. And you, Bishop Miles, you make a proper priest for both of them, don't you?"
"Blasphemy! Blasphemy!"
Somehow Halcombe found the breath to gasp the word through the vice of despair tightening about his throat. "Really?" The guardsman's laugh was carved from the ebon heart of hell. "Then take that thought with you, my lord bishop. Maybe you can share it with Langhorne while you squat on the coals." Halcombe was still staring at him in horror when the katana in the guardsman's right hand sliced through his neck. 15. The Guest House, Convent of St. Agatha, Earldom of Crest Hollow, Kingdom of Caris. Charlian finished reloading the last of the rifles and propped it upright against the wall beside its fellows.
"What's happening, Edward?"
she asked softly as she started on the pistols.
"I don't know, Your Majesty."
Her last surviving guardsman stood to one side of the smashed window, staying as much under cover as he could as he peered out into the rain while blood dribbled down his slashed cheek and his voice was taut.
"In fact, I don't have the least damned idea saving your presence," he admitted. "All I can say is that if there's no more fighting, and no one's trying to climb in through this window or come through that door—"
he twitched his head in the direction of the bedchamber doorway—
"we're a lot better off than we were. And,"
he turned to give her a tight, blood-streaked smile,
"if we are, I think I've just experienced my first miracle."
Charlian surprised herself with a laugh, There was perhaps a shaky edge of hysteria in it, but it truly was a laugh, and she cupped her face in her palms, pressing her fingertips against her temples. She felt the stickiness of blood on her hands. Some of it was actually hers, oozing from the cuts on her scalp and the left side of her forehead, where splinters of broken shutter had cut the skin as the arbalest bolts came screaming past her. More blood had splashed her long skirts and Carizian-style overtunic, and her face and hands were blackened and smeared with powder smoke. Her right shoulder throbbed painfully, and she didn't want to think about how badly bruised it was. If she hadn't been able to move her right arm, painful though the experience had proven, she would have believed that shoulder must be broken. The smell of gun smoke, blood, and death was almost overpowering, despite the pelting rain's washing effect. Water blowing in through the broken window had diluted some of the blood puddled thickly on the bedchamber floor, and fresh blood still dripped from the tip of Sea Hamper's bayonet, like thick, pearl-shaped tears. Emotional shock drew a blessed patina of unreality between her and the world about her. Her brain worked with almost unnatural clarity, yet the thoughts seemed somehow distant, and the tearing grief she knew waited for her could not yet break through. "It will," she told herself bleakly. "It will, when you look around and you never see all those faces again." She prayed desperately that at least one of her guardsmen besides Sea Hamper was still alive, and guilt clogged her throat as she realized how unspeakably grateful she was that if only one could have survived, it had been the sergeant. But, "Your Majesty," a deep voice spoke from the thunderstorm, and Charlian's hands snapped down from her face, and her head jerked up as she recognized it.
"Langhorn,"
Sea Hamper hissed, as he, too, recognized that impossible voice. The guardsman stepped reflexively between his empress and the window, and his bloody bayonet rose once more, protectively.
"Your Majesty," the voice said again, "I realize this is all going to be a bit difficult to explain,"
it continued, and despite all of the horror which had invaded this dreadful night, Charlian heard an edge of dry humor in the words.
"But you're safe now."
"I regret," the voice had darkened once more, "that I couldn't get here sooner."
Captain Athrawes?
Even now, Charlian felt a stab of irritation at the quaver she couldn't quite keep completely out of her voice.
"Don't be such a twit," the back of her brain told her sharply. "On a night like this, even one of the archangels would probably sound shaken."
"Yes, Your Majesty,"
Merlin replied, and stepped close enough to the window for both of them to see him. Sea Hamper's bayonet point rose a little higher, and he seemed to settle even more solidly into place, but Charlian leaned around him, looking past him, and Merlin studied her expression with his enhanced vision. She looked terrible, he thought. Her hair had slipped its elaborate coiffure and hung in random braids. Her face was smeared with blood and powder smoke, and her eyes were dark with the knowledge of how many men she'd known and cared about, had died to protect her. Yet even after all of that, the familiar, sharp intelligence still lived in those eyes as well. Despite shock, grief, loss, and now the fact that she was forced to confront the sheer impossibility of his own presence, she was still thinking, still attacking the problem before her, rather than retreating in dazed confusion or denial.
"My God," he thought. "My God, did Caleb luck out with you, lady."
"How..."
Charlian paused and cleared her throat.
"How can you be here, Merlin?" She shook her head. "Not even a Sajan can be in two places at once."
"No, Your Majesty, he can't."
Merlin bowed slightly, still staying far enough back to avoid triggering any protective reaction on Sea Hamper's part, and drew a deep breath.
2 hours ago, I was in Coruscant, in my tent, he told her.
2 hours? Charlian stared at him, then shook her head.
No, that isn't possible, she said flatly.
Yes, it is, he said, his tone compassionate.
It's entirely possible, Your Majesty. It simply requires certain things you don't know about, yet.
Yet? She pounced on the adverb like a cat lizard on a near-rat, and he nodded.
Your Majesty, Caleb doesn't know I'm here. There wasn't enough time for me to tell him and still get here soon enough to do any good. As it is, I was barely in time. The problem is that there are secrets not even Caleb is free to share, even with you, as badly as he's wanted to ever since you arrived in Telesburg. How I got here, how I knew you were in danger, are part of those secrets. But despite all the reasons he hasn't been able to tell you, I had to decide on my own authority whether to risk letting you learn about them or to stand by and do nothing while you were killed. I couldn't do that. So now I have no choice but to tell you at least a part of the truth.
Your Majesty, Seahamper began sharply.
Wait, Edward. She touched him gently on his armored shoulder. Wait, she repeated, and her eyes seemed to bore into Merlin.
No mortal man could have done what you've done, Sajin Merlin, she said after a moment. The fact that you appeared so miraculously to save my life, and Edward's, inclines me to feel nothing but gratitude for God's miraculous, she reused the word deliberately, intervention. But there are other possible explanations.
Yes, Your Majesty, there are. And that's precisely why the secrets of which I spoke are so carefully guarded. Karis's enemies, your enemies, would immediately proclaim that my capabilities must be demonic and use that accusation to attack everything you and Caleb hope to accomplish.
But you're about to tell me they'd be wrong, aren't you?
I am. On the other hand, I'm as aware as you are that even if I were a demon, I'd be telling you I'm not. I had this same conversation with Caleb before Darko Sound, but he'd already known me for over a year by then. You haven't. I know that will make any explanation I can give you even harder to believe and accept, but I beg you to at least try.
Sajin Merlin, she said, her lips twisting wryly. Whatever you may be, I wouldn't be alive to be having this conversation or feeling any crisis of doubt without your intervention. Edward wouldn't be hovering here ready to stick a bayonet clear through you if he thought you intended to harm me either. And that's almost as important to me as all the rest of it. Under the circumstances, I suppose the least I can do is at least listen to what you have to say.
Seahamper stirred slightly, but he kept his jaw clamped tightly.
Thank you, Your Majesty, Merlin said with the utmost sincerity. But then he shook his head with a snort. Unfortunately, I don't really have time to give you the complete story. It's already daylight in Coruscant, and no one, including Caleb, knows where I am. I've got to get back there as quickly as possible.
You seem to be living an even more complicated life than I'd realized, Charlian observed, and he chuckled.
Your Majesty, you don't know the half of it, he told her. I think you're going to have to, though. No, I mean. For now, I ask you to accept, tentatively at least, that I'm neither an angel nor a demon. That the things I can do don't violate any natural or sacred law, however the Inquisition might regard them. That I wish you and Caleb well, and that I will do all in my power to serve and protect both of you. That there are other people, good and godly people, who know about me and my abilities. And,
he looked directly into her eyes,
that I will die before I allow men like Jaspar Clinton to go on using God himself as an excuse to kill and torture in the name of their own ambition and perverted beliefs.
You're asking me to accept, even if only tentatively, a great deal, Charlian pointed out.
I know that, if you can, though, at least until you return to Tellisburg. I'll try to prove the truthfulness of all I've just told you. I'll admit now that I can't prove all of it, but if you'll see to it that the balcony outside your quarters in the palace is clear all night on your first night back in Tellisburg, I think I'll be able to produce a friendly witness you'll feel able to trust.
Caleb? She asked quickly, her face lighting, and Merlin nodded.
Managing the arrangements so that he and I can both disappear for several hours without sending the entire army into a furor is going to be difficult, you understand. That's one reason I can't give you a specific hour for our arrival. But I feel quite confident that when I tell him about what happened here tonight, he'll insist on coming to you himself. And, now that I think about it, I have two additional requests.
Which are? She asked as he paused.
First, Your Majesty, there's the rather ticklish problem of what we do about your safety and the identity of the people who orchestrated this attack. And I still haven't decided whether or not to tell you your own uncle was one of them, he thought.
The identity, she repeated, and he nodded.
There aren't any survivors of the actual attack on the convent, Your Majesty, he said grimly.
His enhanced vision noticed how Charlian's eyes widened, and how Sea Hamper's narrowed in satisfaction.
There are a few wounded over near the bivouac area, but I'll deal with them before I leave. I don't much like having to do that, but I'm afraid I don't have a choice this time. If any of them were to realize I'd been here, the consequences could be disastrous. However, there are two bodies out beyond the main gate. One of them no longer has a head, although it's close enough to the body, Edward should be able to find it. I think it would be a very good idea for him to do just that.
May I ask why, Sajan Merlin?
Of course you may, Your Majesty. Up until a few minutes ago, that head belonged to one Miles Halcombe, the ex-bishop of Margaret Bay.
Charlian looked at him in disbelief, but Sea Hamper grunted as if in sudden understanding.
Apparently, the good bishop has been providing organization and leadership to the temple loyalists in Caris ever since he decamped from Hanthtown. I think it would be a good idea to take his head back to Tellisburg, where his fellow bishops can positively identify it. And while they're doing that, you might mention to Baron Wave Thunder that Trevir Kyrie has been the main source of Halcombe's funding. Tell him I can't prove that yet, but that I'm sure he'll find the evidence he needs if he looks under the right rocks. Tell him that in particular, he might want to take a close look at the crew of Kyrie's schooner, Sunrise. And if he does, maybe I won't have to be the one to tell you about your uncle after all. That's probably cowardly of me, but right this minute I don't really care.
I think we can probably manage that, Charlian told him, her voice equally grim. And the second thing you wanted?
Edward loves you, Your Majesty. Merlin said gently. And right now, he's afraid of what I might still turn out to be. So I'd like to ask you to do two additional things for me when you return to Tellisburg. First, speak privately to the Archbishop. Tell him every single thing I've just told you, and seek his judgment on whether or not you should listen to anything more. And second, please arrange for Edward to be there as well when Caleb and I turn up. I think no one would be surprised if you feel the need for a little additional security after something like this, so perhaps you could insist that Colonel Ropewalk post Edward on your balcony.
I want him to hear everything Caleb and I tell you when we tell you. I want him to be able to make up his own mind and to know that no one and nothing is attempting to harm you."
"I can do both of those things," Charlian assured him, not trying to hide her relief at his mention of the Archbishop.
"Thank you, Your Majesty." He bowed deeply, then straightened and met Seahamper's eyes. "You did well here tonight, Sergeant," he told the Chisomian quietly. "Her Majesty is fortunate to have you."
Seahamper said nothing, and Merlin smiled crookedly.
"I know you're still trying to make up your mind about me, Edward. I'm not surprised. In your place, I'd probably have already gone ahead and stuck that bayonet into me. If you'll allow me to, I'd like to give you a little advice, though."
His tone turned the final sentence into a question. After a moment, Seahamper nodded.
"I'm reasonably certain I've identified and dealt with, or will have dealt with shortly at any rate, all of the Temple Loyalists behind this particular attack. I can't be absolutely positive of that, however. And even if I could, there's no way you could be. So I think the proper way for you to proceed is to assume that you and the rest of Her Majesty's detachment managed to deal with the attackers, but not to be overly confident that there aren't one or two of them left still in the woods. Under those circumstances, the logical thing for you to do would be to send one of the sisters, or their gardener, if the abbess can dig him out of his hiding place under his bed, to Dancer with a message for Captain Hywitt. Tell him you want a company of his marines loaded for Kraken as an escort back to the ship. And while you're waiting for it to arrive, find some place safe to park Her Majesty while you stay between her and any doors or windows."
Seahamper considered Merlin's words carefully. Under normal circumstances, he would have taken them as an order, given Merlin's rank in the Imperial Guard. As it was, he was obviously thinking about their source with a rather greater degree of suspicion than usual. After several seconds, however, he nodded again.
"Thank you," Merlin said, his smile turning even more crooked for a moment. Then he bowed once more to Charlian. "And now, if you'll excuse me, Your Majesty, I really must be getting back to Coruscant."
"Oh, of course, Agent Merlin," she said with a faint, slightly shaky smile of her own. "Don't let me delay you."
"Thank you, Your Majesty," he repeated, and disappeared into the pounding rain.
Charlian looked out the window after him for several seconds, then turned to Seahamper.
"Your Majesty, is this wise?" he asked her,
and she laughed a bit wildly.
"Wise, Edward? After a night like this one?" She shook her head. "I have no idea. I only know that without him, whoever and whatever he truly is, you and I would both be dead at this moment. Beyond that, I don't have the faintest idea of what's truly happening here. But I do know Archbishop Michael and Caleb are good men. If they know Merlin's secrets and trust him as deeply as they obviously do, then I'm prepared to at least listen to what he has to say. And I think he has a point about you as well. I think it is important that you hear the same things I do."
Seahamper looked at her long and intently, and then he began to nod.
"I think you're right, Your Majesty," he said slowly. "I don't know what to think about all of this either. But you're right about one thing. That man, or whatever he really is, saved your life tonight. I owe him at least the chance to explain how he did it."
"Good, Edward," she said softly, and then drew a deep breath of her own.
"Right now," she said sadly, "I think it's time we went and found the abbess and told her I'm still alive."
16. Emperor Caleb's Headquarters Tent, Duchy of Manchir, League of Coruscant.
"I don't suppose there's been any word from Merlin."
Lieutenant Franz Austin, the second in command of Emperor Caleb's personal guard, looked up as the Emperor poked his head out through the flaps of his command tent with one eyebrow raised.
"No, Your Majesty," the lieutenant replied. "Not yet, I'm afraid."
"Well, at least he's capable of looking after himself," the Emperor said philosophically, and withdrew into his tent once more. Austin gazed at the closed tent flaps for a moment, then glanced at Pater Faircaster. The huge sergeant was the only other member of the Emperor's personal guard, aside from Captain Athrawus himself, who'd been with him when he was still Crown Prince. Which meant he was also the only one of them who'd served with Sajan Merlin ever since the mysterious foreigner had appeared in Karras.
"Don't ask me, sir," Faircaster shrugged. "You know how much the Emperor relies on the captain's insights. If he's decided something's important enough to send the captain off to take a personal look at it, then he must think it's really important. Like he says, though, the captain can look after himself."
That last sentence, Austin reflected, had to be the most mammoth case of understatement he'd ever heard in his entire life. Austin hadn't personally seen the Sajan perform any of the impossible feats legend described to him. For his own part, the lieutenant was willing to assume the impossible feats in question had grown in the telling, which didn't mean Merlin wasn't the most dangerous man he'd ever known anyway. All of Caleb's personal guard had worked out against the Sajan. No one was accepted for the detail which was already becoming known as the Emperor's Own until Merlin had personally tried him out in a no-holds-barred sparring contest, and none of them had ever managed to best him with practice blades, hand-to-hand, or on the rifle range. In fact, none of them had even managed to make him sweat. Despite that, the tales about him carving his way single-handedly through hundreds of enemies aboard Royal Karras at the Battle of Darko Sound probably weren't true. Probably. Austin wasn't quite prepared to bet money on that, but he was pretty sure he didn't really believe it. After all, no matter how good the Sajan might be, he was still only a single mortal man. Probably. Personally, the lieutenant suspected the tales about Merlin's prodigious lethality had been quietly encouraged by the then Crown Prince and his marine bodyguards. Focusing on his deadliness as a warrior had undoubtedly been a part of the careful cover story, which had been constructed to protect the truth about Merlin's greatest value to Karras. Austin hadn't really believed it when he and the rest of the Emperor's Own were first briefed on the Sajan's visions. It had sounded far too much like the children's tales about Sajan Cody and his magical powers. In this case, however, the tales had happened to be true. Austin had seen too many examples of the Emperor using those visions to doubt that, and he understood perfectly why it was essential to keep anyone else from knowing about the Sajan's true capabilities. And making certain everyone knew Merlin was the most deadly bodyguard in the world, which, after all, didn't take that much exaggeration, was the perfect way to explain why he was always at the Emperor's shoulder. He wasn't there as the Emperor's most trusted and insightful advisor, as Sergeant Faircaster had so aptly put it. He was there to keep the Emperor alive. Which helped to explain why the other members of the detail had been more than a little concerned when the Sajan didn't turn up for breakfast. Merlin always ate early, before the Emperor was up, so that he could be already on duty while Caleb was served, and he was as persistently perfect in his timing as he was with a sword. So, when he was a full 15 minutes late, Austin had poked his head cautiously into the small tent Merlin had been assigned for his personal use. He'd expected to find the Sajan sitting cross-legged in the middle of the tent's floor, concentrating on one of his visions. That, after all, was the reason he'd been assigned a private tent in the first place. To the lieutenant's astonishment, however, the tent had been empty, and the bedroll looked as if it hadn't been used at all. That had been totally unprecedented, and more than enough to send Austin to the Emperor. To the best of Austin's knowledge, Captain Athrawes had never once been absent when he was supposed to be on duty, and he'd certainly never simply disappeared in the middle of the night without at least telling someone he intended to. For that matter, Austin had felt more than a little miffed by the clear evidence that Merlin had somehow gotten through the protective ring around the Emperor without a single one of Caleb's guardsmen noticing him. The man might be a Sajan, but he wasn't invisible. Fortunately, the Emperor at least knew where Merlin had gone. Austin had waited patiently while Galvan Dakin went in and roused the sleeping Emperor. Then the valet had poked his head out of the Emperor's sleeping quarters and beckoned for the guardsman to enter with his message. For just a moment, Austin had thought he saw surprise in Caleb's eyes, but he'd obviously been wrong. "I'm sorry, Franz," the Emperor had said, shaking his head with a wry smile. "I told Merlin I didn't want anyone to know, but I didn't expect him to take me quite that literally. I'd assumed that he'd at least tell the rest of the detail I'd decided to send him off."
"Send him off, Your Majesty?"
Austin had repeated.
"Yes," Caleb had stood and stretched, yawning hugely, before he accepted a tunic from Dakin. "Let's just say I needed a message taken to someone who couldn't exactly be seen opening a letter from me. Not if he wanted to keep his head, at least."
Austin's eyes had widened for a moment. Then he'd understood, and the fact that the Sajan had been able to filter through his own sentries without anyone spotting him explained exactly why the Emperor had chosen him to carry a critical message to one of his agents behind the Coruscantian lines. "Obviously," the Emperor had continued, turning back to face Austin as he belted the tunic, "I'd prefer that no one else know about this."
"Of course, Your Majesty," Austin had half-bowed. "I'll brief the rest of the detail immediately."
"Thank you, Franz, and I apologize. I'd rather hoped Merlin would be back by now. I hadn't expected you to have to cover his watch as well as your own."
"Don't worry about that, Your Majesty," Austin had smiled. "Captain Athrawes works longer hours than any of the rest of us. I don't mind giving up a little of my own off-duty time if you need me to."
"I know," the Emperor had grinned at him. "Still, it would have been polite of me to at least warn you about it ahead of time."
Austin had merely smiled, touched his left shoulder in salute, and withdrawn from the Emperor's sleeping tent. He rather doubted that any other king or emperor on the face of Safehold would have worried his head for a moment over the convenience or inconvenience of one of his bodyguards. Still, it was becoming apparent that even the Emperor was growing impatient. It wouldn't be fair to call Caleb's attitude worried, but that might be because, like Austin himself, he found it impossible to conceive of any situation Merlin wouldn't be able to handle. There had to be one, of course. Austin simply couldn't imagine what it might be. On the other hand...
"Sorry I'm late, Franz."
The lieutenant twitched and snapped around in disbelief as a deep, familiar voice spoke from behind him.
"Merlin?"
"In the flesh, as it were," Merlin replied with a broad smile.
"Damn it, sir!"
Austin glowered at the neatly uniformed apparition which appeared to have sprung up out of the very ground.
"I know you're a Sajan, but how in Langhorne's name did you manage that?"
"Manage what?"
Merlin's expression was innocence itself.
"You know exactly what," Austin half snapped. "It's bad enough you got past all of us on the way out, but if you can get past us on the way in as well, then maybe someone else could too."
"Actually, Franz, I wouldn't worry about that."
Merlin shook his head, and genuine contrition softened his smile.
No one else is going to be able to duplicate the technique I just used. Believe me.
I'm beginning to think there's a lot more truth to all the old-fashioned magic stories about Sajin than I thought there was, Austin said.
It's not magic, Franz. Just training and a few enhanced abilities.
Sure it is.
Well, unless you're prepared...